Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on an iBook from the Library of Congress that has hundreds of very interesting photographs for a surprisingly low price. We talk with the editor who looked through tens of thousands of photographs to choose just 730.
First and foremost, I wanted just something that you look at it and you immediately think, oh, that's interesting, or something that you look at it for a split second and you look away and then you have to look back at it because you might have, you know, you think, wait, what was that I just saw?
How new technology is letting America's Library of Congress sell a book with 730 photographs for less than $6. That is our story today on As It Is. What if you were asked to choose just 730 photographs from among 1.25 million images, and you had just a few months in which to complete the project? Most people would say it could not be done. Amy Hess is not most people.
When this project originated, I just sort of, you know, raised my hand and said, me.
Amy Hess served as the editor of a book called Great Photographs from the Library of Congress. She is a writer and editor in the publishing division of the Library of Congress here in Washington, D.C. The library is the country's oldest federal cultural institution. It was founded in 1800. During her time at the Library of Congress, Ms. Hess had worked on many projects and books about photography collections. She became known as an expert on such books. But she had never worked on something as big as the iBook project. It was made available to iPad users late last year.
I looked at a lot of photographs. Yeah, in the collection, there's more than 12 million items, and this is just in the prints and photographs division. But because we were working on an ebook, I decided to only look through the photographs that had been digitized, and so we estimate that at about 1.25 million photographs. I wouldn't say I looked at every single one, but I definitely looked at a good 50,000 to 60,000 photographs.
She needed several months to look at all those pictures. She looked at 20 to 100 small images at one time on a computer screen. After looking at tens of thousands of pictures, Amy Hess saved between 6,000 and 10,000 of them. Now came the hard part, choosing just 730 to put into the iBook. It took her 6 weeks to make those decisions. Ms. Hess says she expected criticism of her choices. Questions such as, why did you choose that photograph? Or, why didn't you include this one? But they never came.
You know, you can't please everyone with a book like this, especially when there's just so much material I could have included. But actually, it's been more, the comments have been more positive just oh, wow, these images are amazing. A lot of readers, you know, have said they had no idea that the Library of Congress had images like this. And so that's, you know, exactly what we wanted. We wanted people to realize that we have these in our collections and that these images are for everybody. They're for the public. You know, you can use these images. So it's been really positive. Nobody's really complained about or nitpicked. I think people are just happy that we did it.
The work of some of the most famous photographers in U.S. history is included in the iBook. But Ms. Hess says most of the pictures are from people like you and me.
The bulk of the book are these unknown photographers, and their photographic contributions are just as important and just as interesting and compelling as these household names. So I think it's really nice that we're giving them their due.
She says a good photograph makes you want to look at the image again and again. You want to keep it. It pulls you into it. It makes you want to walk into it and join it.
First and foremost, I wanted just something that you look at it and you immediately think, oh, that's interesting, or something that you look at it for a split second and you look away and then you have to look back at it because you might have, you know, you think, wait, what was that I just saw? Or, you know, I was really looking for photographs that moved me, that had action, that were beautiful, but also I tended to look for photographs that represented, you know, historical events.
The iBook was released last November. Ms. Hess says at one time it was the top-selling photography iBook in Apple's online store. It costs just $5.99 on iTunes. More than 100 have been sold. But if more people knew about the book, she says, many more would be sold. The photographs start from earlier times, but include recent images, too. There are 8 chapters, The World and Its Cultures, American Indians, African Americans, Images of America, Accidents and Disasters, Architecture, Design and Engineering, War, and Famous People. Because it is an iBook, there are computer addresses or links that permit the reader to go online to learn more about the pictures. Included are pictures of people who have changed the world and events that have changed history. Amy Hess says the technology of e-publishing enables the Library of Congress to make a book that more people can buy and with more images than a printed version would have.
If we had done this book in print, I think it likely would have contained fewer than half as many photos, and it would have been one of those big, bulky, heavy art books, and, you know, I estimate that would probably sell for about $75.
Ms. Hess says she hopes that in the future, the iBook will also be available as an e-book. That way, people who do not use Apple computers or other Apple devices will be able to enjoy it. Of the thousands of pictures she looked at, which one is her favorite?
Well, I'll never pick one favorite, so I'll have to pick a few favorites.
One of them is a picture from Denali National Park in Alaska. She says it is one of the most beautiful pictures she has ever seen. We've put it and 5 more of her favorite photos on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Christopher Cruz. Please join us again tomorrow at this same time for another edition of As It Is, here on the Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Mildred Alma lives in Kibera, a large and poor neighborhood in Nairobi, Kenya. Every morning, she wakes up her 4-year-old son, Augustine, and gets him ready for school. The boy has a glass of milk and a piece of bread before he leaves home. Augustine is among only a few local students who get anything to eat before going to class. His school, the Seed School Kibera, began offering early childhood education to poor children 7 years ago. Today, 60 students are taking part in the program. They are from 3 to 14 years of age. Benjamin Odiambo has taught at the school for the past 2 years. He says it helps both the minds and bodies of its students.
The children look forward to the meals because most of these children come from less privileged families. This is the only meal they can afford within a day. So we are not just feeding them physically, but we are also nourishing them intellectually.
Few people in Kibera have jobs, and most children come to school hungry. That means they may have problems keeping their attention focused on schoolwork, and they may not learn well. So the school started a food program. At 10 in the morning, children have porridge to eat. And at 1 o'clock, they eat a hot meal before leaving for home 3 hours later. In Kibera, Mildred Alma is among the few people who own a business that can provide for her family's basic needs. She earns about $10 a day from selling groundnuts and buns, a kind of bread. But she is still grateful for the meals her son gets in school. She says the school is close to her business. She praises the school for giving him meals. But Augustine may not be able to stay there when he graduates from class 3, his present grade level. She says if that happens, she will ask for help in finding a place for him in a similar school. Patrick Auki is the school's director. He says the food program gets money from parents who make beaded jewelry. Sales of jewels and necklaces provide about $120 a month.
We have an economical challenge in the slums. So one major thing we actually do is to offer a feeding program for the children. This supports them actually to be able to grow intellectually and maybe physically to be able to concentrate in their learning.
This education may prove a way out of poverty into a more promising future. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report for today. I'm Jerry Watson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The American Civil War in the 1860s was fought not only on land. There was a great deal of fighting between the Union and Confederate navies. This part of the war, the Sea War, is often forgotten,
but it was important. The Union victory might not have been possible without the successes of its navy. Many battles took place just off the coast of the United States. Many others took place farther away in international waters. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about the naval side of the Civil War.
As soon as the war started, President Abraham Lincoln wanted to block the South's major ports. He wanted to prevent the South from shipping its agricultural products to other countries in exchange for industrial goods. Lincoln's plan was good, but it had one major weakness. The Union Navy was too small for the job. The Confederate seacoast was long. It extended from Chesapeake Bay to Mexico, a distance of 5,600 kilometers. There were not enough ships in the Union Navy to blockade all of it. Many months would pass before the Union could build up an effective naval force.
The Confederacy had no navy at the start of the Civil War. The Confederate government had little money to create one, and the South had no factories to build one. For a while, the Confederacy was able to get warships from Britain. Then the Union put diplomatic pressure on Britain to stop this support. For the most part, the Confederacy depended on privately owned ships to get goods in and out of the South. About 20 of these private ships flew the Confederate flag. Most were very successful in the beginning. The Florida, for example, captured more than 30 ships before being captured itself off the coast of Brazil in 1864. The Alabama captured more than 60 ships. It was finally sunk in a battle with the Kearsarge off the coast of France. The Shenandoah sailed in the Pacific Ocean. It captured 40 ships. After the war ended, the Shenandoah tied up in Liverpool, England.
In addition to these victories, the Confederacy claimed responsibility for several new naval technologies during the Civil War. One was the first modern submarine. This ship was 10 meters long. It sank four times while being tested. It was raised each time and put back into service. One night, it fired its torpedoes at a much larger Union ship and sank it. But the explosion was so great that it tore apart the submarine, and it sank too. The Confederacy also developed very effective underwater explosive devices for use in the harbors.
Even with its victories and technologies, however, the Confederacy could not stop the Union Navy. The Union Navy was bigger to begin with and grew much faster. During the first 2 years of the Civil War, the Union captured several southern ports, Fort Hatteras and Roanoke Island, North Carolina, Port Royal, South Carolina, Pensacola, Florida, and perhaps most importantly, New Orleans, Louisiana. New Orleans lay near the mouth of the Mississippi River. It was the largest city in the South. It was the largest seaport. It had become a busy industrial center, producing war equipment for Confederate forces. If the Union could capture New Orleans, it would control the Mississippi River. President Lincoln appointed Navy officer David Farragut to lead the attack on New Orleans.
To reach the city, Farragut had to sail his ships past two Confederate forts on the Mississippi River. He shelled the forts for 6 days and nights, but the forts were so strong that the shells caused little damage. He decided not to wait any longer. One dark night, Farragut led 17 Union warships up the river in a line. The Confederate forces heard them and began to fire. One ship was sunk. Three others were damaged so badly that they could not continue. But 13 made it safely past the forts. When Farragut reached New Orleans, he found the city defenseless. Several thousand Confederate soldiers had fled. They knew they could not defend against the bigger Union force. Only civilians remained. Farragut captured New Orleans without a fight. The Confederate flag was lowered, and the United States flag was raised over the city.
Several weeks before Farragut captured New Orleans, a new kind of Navy battle was fought off Hampton Roads, Virginia. It was the first battle between iron ships. On the Confederate side was the Virginia. It had been built from what remained of a captured Union warship called the Merrimack. The Virginia was like no other warship ever seen in the world. It was 80 meters long. The part that showed above the waterline was built of wood 60 centimeters thick. This part was covered with sheets of iron 10 centimeters thick. 10 windows were cut into it. Behind each window was a cannon. In a battle, the windows would open, the cannons would fire, and the windows would close again. At the front was a sharp point of iron that could smash through the sides of wooden ships. The Virginia could not move fast, and it was difficult to control. It took almost 30 minutes to turn around. Still, there seemed to be no way to stop this iron monster. It already had destroyed two Union warships, and it was coming back for more.
The Union ship chosen to fight the Virginia was the Monitor. It, too, was covered with iron, but it was much smaller than the Virginia, and it carried only two cannons. These two cannons, however, were on a part of the ship that could turn in a complete circle. They could be aimed in any direction. The Monitor and the Virginia faced each other on the morning of March 9th, 1862. They moved in close, very close, then began to fire. A Confederate cannonball hit the iron side of the Monitor and bounced away. Union sailors cheered. The cannons of the Virginia could do no damage. But the Union sailors soon discovered that their cannons could do no damage either.
The men inside the two ships suffered from noise, heat, and smoke. The roar of their own cannons was extremely loud. Even louder was the crash of enemy cannonballs and explosive shells on the iron walls. Some of the men suffered burst eardrums. at least one man was struck unconscious from the force of a cannonball against the iron. The men quickly learned to stay away from the walls. Smoke from the cannons filled the ships. Then it floated out over the water. At times, the two ships could not see each other.
The Virginia and the Monitor fought for 3 hours. Neither ship scored an important hit. Neither suffered serious damage. Then the cannons of the Virginia fell silent. The Confederate ship had used up its gunpowder. It also had used up much of its fuel. It was lighter now and was floating higher in the water. A well-aimed cannonball could hit below its iron covering and sink it. The Confederate captain decided to withdraw. The Union captain, too, was ready to break off the battle. He decided not to follow. Neither ship could claim victory. But the Monitor had kept the Virginia from destroying more of the Union's wooden warships. The Virginia itself was to live just 2 more months. Union forces seized the Confederate Navy base at Norfolk, where the Virginia was kept. And the Iron Monster was sunk to keep it from falling into Union hands.
The battle at Hampton Roads between the Virginia and the Monitor was undecisive. It did not have much effect on the final result of America's Civil War. But it was still an important battle, for it marked the beginning of the end of the world's wooden navies. We will continue our story of the Civil War next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley and Christine Johnson. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found along with historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.